BBC Headlines take us up to 4 minutes past 8 o'clock. Good morning. You're listening to Community Radio, listener-supported KGNU. I'm Maeve Conran, and coming up on today's Morning Magazine. Ahead of the first day of the new state legislative session, which is tomorrow, we'll speak with the ACLU of Colorado about why they're calling on lawmakers to re-examine the budget for the Department of Corrections and the DOC's plans to reopen a prison in the state. Then, with the government shutdown now almost reaching 2 weeks, nearly 300 federal workers in Colorado have filed for unemployment, but there are thousands of other workers that are impacted. We'll hear from a nonprofit in Jefferson County who's a neighbour to the federal centre that employs thousands of workers. We'll hear how they are ready and able to help any federal workers impacted by the shutdown. Then, as part of our ongoing series, The Brink, we'll hear about food insecurity amongst senior citizens. John Lendorf will be in with the latest food news. And then, just after 8:30 this morning, Hunter Lovins joins us live in the studio to discuss her latest book, A Finer Future. Lovins is the co-founder and president of Natural Capitalism Solutions. And her book, Natural Capitalism, was first published 20 years ago. And that sparked the sustainable business revolution. But first, we'll begin with the latest local headlines. Here's Hannah Lee Myers.
This week, anti-oil and gas development groups from across the state are intensifying efforts to stop the skyrocketing number of well permits filed with the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. The COGCC says in the wake of the failure of Prop 12, that's the oil and gas setback measure that was on the ballot last November, they're seeing nearly three times the number of well applications than what they saw at the start of 2018. In response, the Denver Post reports multiple community groups are sending letters to Colorado Governor-elect Jared Polis today and Friday, asking him to put a hold on all new drilling permits until studies assessing the health risks associated with living near extraction sites are complete. Wednesday, Polis did not answer questions about the letters, but the COGCC did have a spokesperson respond, and they told the Denver Post that they're not sure how much power Polis actually has to issue a stop on new well applications, considering this issue has never arisen before. Polis, who has made environmental protection part of his political platform, will formally be sworn into office next week. And Friday, the Colorado legislature will restart under fully Democratic control, leaving many hopeful the new state leadership will push back on extraction. In another move to aggressively fight oil and gas development, Colorado Rising, the group behind last year's failed setback bill, that's Prop 112, has hired former state representative Joe Salazar as their executive director. Salazar has a political history of supporting anti-oil and gas measures in favor of protecting public safety. Thursday at noon, Salazar will speak at an anti-oil and gas rally at Civic Center Park in Denver. And Friday morning, Colorado Rising will hold a demonstration against the extraction industry at the state capitol. Wednesday, the Colorado Department of Labor Public Relations told Denver 7 about 300 federal employees have filed for unemployment since the government shutdown began on December 22nd, and more than 100 unemployment claims related to the shutdown were filed in the last 2 days. Coloradans on unemployment receive an average of $450 a week, with a maximum payment of around $600 a week. Any federal employees that are given back pay after the government reopens will have to return their unemployment payments. More on the effect of the shutdown on government employees coming up in the Morning Magazine. Expect a high today around 50 degrees, low tonight somewhere around 30. We see similar high temperatures under sunny skies all the way through the weekend. It's currently around 28 degrees on the Front Range. For KGNU, I'm Hannah Lee Myers.
It's 8 minutes past 8 o'clock. Well, state lawmakers will reconvene at the Capitol tomorrow morning for the first day of the 2019 legislative session. It's likely going to be a busy time with many issues on the legislative agenda: oil and gas regulation, education and transportation funding, and of course healthcare. But the ACLU of Colorado are hoping that legislators will also prioritize reforming criminal justice, and particularly they're asking them to take a hard look at the Department of Corrections budget. Denise Mayes of the ACLU of Colorado says she's asking lawmakers to scrutinize the department's request to reopen Centennial South Prison, or CSP2.
There was a period of time where the projections for the Colorado prison population were thought to be increasing, and so there was hundreds of millions of dollars that were put into reopening CSP2. And what I want to remind your listeners about is that CSP2 was built as a solitary confinement facility, which is to say the prison cells within that facility were built to have the least amount of human contact as possible. So it was intended to be an ADSEG, an administrative segregation facility. And thankfully, we had for quite a few years a decreasing prison population, and so that facility was never used. So we spent hundreds of millions of dollars into a facility that has never been opened or ever used. It was mothballed. Parts of it have been open primarily for intake and reentry services, but the admin segregation units themselves have not been reopened. What we have noticed now in the last maybe couple of years, we're now again seeing the prison population on the increase, and the Department of Corrections over the last year has made the case, or tried to make the case, that their prison capacity is so small, so low, that they need to find other alternatives, and trying to prepare CSP2 for reopening is one of the things, one of the items that they have put on their list. That is reflected in the DOC budget. It's reflected in Governor Hickenlooper's budget. And what we're hoping is that it will not be reflected in Governor-elect Polis's budget, and that the state legislature will not approve these continued requests for more prison space and more prison openings, and instead, like I mentioned earlier, to focus on how we can bring the prison population under control as we had been able to do so in the decade before.
Well, given some of the recent changes that we've actually seen to laws here in the state, particularly the decriminalization of cannabis, why then do you think that the prison population has increased in Colorado?
Well, what we've seen, which I think is really problematic, is what we have seen are a lot of filings by district attorneys for simple drug possession. So even though we have taken care of the marijuana issue, we have not taken care of the simple possession of other controlled substances. The drug filings of drug felony 4, which is simple possession of small amounts of controlled substances, has soared. It actually encompasses now almost 3/4 of all cases filed in every judicial district across the state. And that carries in and of itself an 18-month sentence. And one of the things that we know that there will be discussion above at the legislature is whether or not these certain crimes should really be viewed more as a health issue and not put into the prison system. So really, the increase in the prison population is directly related to those continued drug felony filings that are coming out of district attorney's offices across the state.
You mentioned that the CSP2 prison, the Centennial South Prison, was built because of projections regarding future prison populations. Could you talk about how the Department of Corrections actually comes up with these projections and how that then influences how many prisons are built and how many beds are made available? And then also talk about the role of the private prison industrial complex in all of that.
Sure. So we take a little bit of an issue with the projections. And in fact, over the last 2 months, we've seen their projections to simply not be accurate. For example, we actually saw more individuals that were released in October and November than what they had projected, and fewer people going in. So they actually had a decline in those 2 months, therefore opening more beds and creating more capacity. So their projections are not always accurate, and I I think the second piece to this that I'd like to highlight is toward the end of last session, the legislature passed what is known as House Bill 1410. And what that bill was intended to do was to clear the silos between Department of Corrections, Community Corrections, and the Parole Board, and that there needed to be more discussion and interplay between those three entities so that individuals that are parole eligible are actually getting timely hearing on their parole, and those that are community corrections eligible are timely addressed and sent to community corrections. We haven't seen complete implementation of 1410. It didn't take effect until late summer. So that is only now coming to be, and we think that that will have a significant impact on future projections and actually just future prison population in general. And so that is one of the things that I think all people need to keep in mind. Now, the question of private prisons really is, are there more private prison beds that the state can lease out, if you will, when capacity at Department of Corrections public space becomes, you know, too low or comes to a percentage that makes the DOC nervous? And we just don't think we're there yet, and that we shouldn't jump the gun and start moving in that direction. Again, that is reflected in the DOC budget, and it is reflected in Governor Hickenlooper's budget, but we hope that that will change, in part because of the information that the ACLU and the Colorado Criminal Justice Reform Coalition were able to provide to the governor's office.
Well, I know another component that we have been seeing, at least in certain jurisdictions, is a move to end money bail, because we have had situations where people are languishing sometimes for months in jail pre-trial. So they haven't been convicted of anything because they can't pay what's sometimes a relatively low cash bond, or even they can't even pay the administrative fee that comes along with their detention. And as I said, these people often haven't been found guilty of anything because they haven't even stood trial yet. So what are your thoughts on changes to the money bond system that we're seeing?
Absolutely. And thank you for that question, because one of the things about bail, and I can certainly go on for a long time about money bail in particular, and I'll say a few things about that. But one of the things that we have seen that the data shows is that individuals that languish longer in jail, pre-trial, innocent, presumptively innocent, they simply can't afford the toll to get out, as you explained, that those individuals are oftentimes likely to get a guilty plea either or go to trial and be found guilty, because there's a presumption of all the time that they spent in jail, and they come in, you know, with the orange clothing and in shackles or whatever. And so there are those individuals, those that languish longer in jail are more likely to be found guilty and sentenced to Department of Corrections. So if we can do something about bail and do some serious bail reform, we would also see some improvements in the prison population. And yes, we have had numerous conversations with the governor's office, with legislators, about what we can do to make sure that there aren't innocent people languishing in jail simply because they're poor.
That's Denise Maez of the ACLU of Colorado, ahead of tomorrow's first day of the 2019 state legislative session, on her hopes for some type of legislation to be introduced around criminal justice reform. It's 8:17. You're listening to KGNU. Well, as we heard in headlines, about 300 federal workers in the state have filed for unemployment as the government shutdown heads into a 2-week time mark. Well, there are many other federal workers in the state who are impacted by the shutdown who may not be able to file for unemployment, but they're still significantly impacted. And many of them are in Jefferson County, where the federal centre is located. And one nonprofit there says they're gearing up to help impacted workers. I spoke with Pam Breyer, who's the executive director of the Action Center in Jefferson County.
Well, the Action Center provides an immediate response to basic needs. So many times people are coming in for immediate assistance with food or with clothing items. Sometimes it's rental assistance or mortgage assistance or utility assistance. We see ourselves as helping people to get through the most immediate challenges that they're facing so that they can continue with less stress in their lives and not have to be faced with really difficult decisions like, do I put food on the table or do I pay my rent this month? And then in addition to responding to those immediate needs, we work with folks in the longer term to help them move out of crisis mode and into a more sustainable place for their lives. So we help them to move towards a state of self-sufficiency.
Is there any way to quantify how many federal workers are actually in the area that you serve, in your catchment area?
Well, we know the federal center is right down the street from where the Action Center is, and there are thousands of employees there who are impacted by the furlough. There's NREL as well. So we know we are in the vicinity of many federal employees. We don't yet know how many of those employees have shown up at our doors, but it's still relatively recent, and for many they will just be beginning to feel the real impact of it.
Well, Jefferson County is a big county and it spans many different areas from urban to suburban and then rural as well. So are you finding that there are different needs in the different locations, different parts of the county?
Yeah, I think there can be different needs, but I also think that a lot of the challenges that people experience are the same regardless of where they're living. Sometimes if they're in a more rural community, the job opportunities are fewer. While the housing prices may be a little lower, the opportunities for real strong work may not be there in the same way that they are for people who are closer to the city. So yes, the needs can definitely vary depending on where people live.
Now, as you said earlier, you are very close to the federal center. So what would you like people who may be listening right now, who could be impacted by the shutdown, what would you like them to know?
Mostly I want people to know that we are here for them, that they will, when they come here, they will be treated with respect and no judgment. We want people to feel comfortable as much as possible asking for help, because that's why we are here. And someone who needs help today may not need help tomorrow and may be able to pass on their, better fortune in days to come to people who are still needing assistance. So we just want to encourage people not to feel hesitant to come and ask for help, that we are here and that we can help them with immediate groceries. We can help them with clothing and household items, and we can help them meet their rental and mortgage assistance or energy assistance needs, and hopefully make it much easier for them to manage during what is an unforeseen time of uncertainty for them.
Pam Breyer with the Action Network in Jefferson County. And they're available to help anybody in need in the county. Even if you're not a federal worker and you need help, you can find out more about them and how to contact them online at theactioncenterco.org. Well, all this week and last week and next week, we're playing stories produced by graduate students in the Environmental Studies program at CU Boulder, working with Professor David Siplett. The series is called The Brink, and it takes a look at social, economic and environmental justice issues. Today, we'll hear from student Miranda Stinson, who took a look at food insecurity in Boulder.
They don't want to participate in that.
That's what she does. She lets us know that the food's here.
Boulder Food Rescue, a local organization, delivers produce on a weekly basis to Canyon Point and other food insecure communities like them. The food is delivered directly to the communities where residents volunteer to distribute the food. The current volunteers at Canyon Point are Cindy Holmes and her dog Stella. The two work hard on a weekly basis to set out the deliveries, clean up after, and compost any leftovers.
I've lived at Canyon Point for about a year and a half now. We're all here because we're low-income housing and because we can't afford to live somewhere else. And so all of us are kind of in the same boat, and all of us don't have very much money. And it takes a lot of money to go to the store and get groceries these days. And just the little things that they bring, such as this week I needed some potatoes. And they brought like 6 potatoes, I think. And I took 3 or 4 of them. And it was just what I needed. And you find that that happens with things that people take. It's just like they just happen to need apples, and then here come the apples. So,
with the help of Cindy and Stella, the food relief provided by Boulder Food Rescue has seen an overwhelmingly positive response at Canyon Point.
I don't know what I'd do without this place. Stella and I'd probably be on the street.
Food insecurity is when a person does not have reliable access to sufficient and nutritious foods. It is almost always a result of economic insecurity. For many seniors, economic insecurity combines with multiple other obstacles to make accessing food extremely challenging. Seniors are at a disadvantage because many rely on their Social Security as their only source of income, while transportation and physical mobility make going out to get food a struggle. Boulder Housing Partners has 12 sites for low-income communities. Canyon Point is one of these sites, and it caters to seniors ages 62 and up. Boulder Food Rescue reaches around 21,000 people, like Cindy. The organization moves around 1,600 pounds of food a day, which would have otherwise gone to waste, and they do it all by bicycle. The food goes to 20 non-cost grocery programs around town so that communities like Canyon Point are able to meet their nutritional needs.
I'm one of 5 co-founders, and we started it because we were upset that food was going to waste. People were hungry, so we were just like, let's try something.
Hayden Dansky, the executive director and co-founder of Boulder Food Rescue.
It was a really, really organic process. We understood that food was going to waste for really absurd reasons, like it's not quite perfect, or it looks funny, or maybe a grocery store just gets a new shipment in. And we initially started a meal in the park, and we found that there were people who were saying, this is the healthiest food we get all week, and this is really different because you all sit down and eat with us. And like those kind of, that feedback essentially was what kind of influenced us to create Boulder Food Rescue how it is today, to focus on healthy food and to focus on creating systems that involve people who want to give back.
Hayden Dansky began the organization based on the desire to reduce food waste.
It's not just food recovery. I think that's the biggest misconception. We're rescuing food that would go to waste. We're distributing food to people that wouldn't have it otherwise. But I think beyond that, we're able to like give people a hand and a voice in their own food access. And that is so much deeper than the emergency.
And that's Miranda Stinson, who produced that radio story as part of the Brink series. It is 8:26. You're listening to KGNU, and it's time now for Radio Nibbles.
Have a banana, Hannah. Try the salami, Tommy. Give it the gravy, Davy. Everybody eats when...
And it is Nibbles time with John Lendorf joining us live in the studio. Happy New Year, the first Nibbles of 2019.
Happy New Year, Maeve, and Happy New Year to all my favorite nibblers across the globe.
Well, and as we are heading in now to 2019, it's a good 2019. It's time to really look ahead to the future of food.
Yeah, because we're tired of all that old food. And my Nibbles column this week has to do with the future. Some of it is just scary stuff I've collected so that you can share it around the water cooler and go, oh my goodness. So it's full of that kind of stuff, including some predictions about the future.
So what you got? What's ahead?
It's an interesting question. Now that people are starting to grow meat, grow proteins, a company called Finless, get it, plans on launching lab-grown bluefin tuna paste in 2020. You know, there's a lot to be said. You know, save the tuna and replace it, even though it sounds disgusting. But it raised an interesting question with the Orthodox Union, which is the group which certifies foods as kosher. The question that was put to them is, can a lab-grown meat or fish be certified kosher, and their they're very uncertain at this point.
Is it a synthetic thing? It's fake.
No, they take bluefin tuna cells and then they reproduce them, and you end up with a bluefin tuna paste.
But yet to be discerned whether or not it's actually kosher.
Exactly.
To be decided.
A lot of questionable new foods that I've come across that I think, I don't know what it says about the future, but coming up on a menu near you, Starbucks has basically a pine-flavored juniper latte. And I'm not sure why we needed it.
And that sounds even worse than the pumpkin stuff that gets whipped out every October.
Except this would be like chewing on a branch. Oreos is coming out with an Oreo that has 3 times the filling, which destroys the intricate balance between cookie and filling that I think destroys it. I don't know why Sonic has pickle juice slushies, and I don't know why Shake Shack, which is coming to Boulder, has an eel burger. But coming to a menu near you soon.
Well, those questions, I'm sure, will be, front and foremost in your thoughts as we head into 2019. But in a more maybe mainstream culinary aspect, there are some other culinary trends heading to Denver, including some Israeli-inspired fare.
Yes, and that's particularly interesting because 2 restaurants have just opened in Denver that feature modern Israeli fare, which is different from Middle Eastern. One is Ashkara, which is being opened by the chef from River and Woods, and another place called Safta, which they both feature wood-fired pita. I'm all in favor of warm bread at any time.
Well, it seems that we've had a spate of restaurant closings over the last few nibbles we've been talking about. Some restaurants that have shut their doors, and yet even more now to talk about today.
I mean, I had a whole column full of the places that had closed. And in the meantime, Lunetta, which replaced Arugula, which replaced Laudisio, which replaced A La Carte, closed in North Boulder. Trapita's closed after 22 years in Niwot. The Cup closed in downtown Boulder, and even Ted's Montana Grill.
A lot of places to close, but there are even more predictions for what's ahead in 2019 in this week's Nibbles column in the Boulder Weekly. Well, apart from not simulated, but lab-grown tuna, have you tasted anything terribly interesting, or really what's the best thing that you've tasted recently?
I'm going to take a brief flashback to 2018. The best thing I ate over the Christmas holidays was mincemeat pie. You might appreciate that it's a rarity around here, and I decided to introduce my son to what I had grown up with, or something like it. I got a mincemeat pie from Karen DiVincenzo, who cooks and bakes for the Jamestown Mercantile. It was great. Flaky crust, candied orange peel, dried fruit, brandy, pear, apples, cherries. It was great.
Well, I need to get on that list for next year, because that reminds me of growing up. Mincemeat pies are the best. Well, you can read John's column about Rocky Mountain oysters in the January issue of Scentsy magazine. Of course, you can catch archived radio nibbles online at news.kgnu.org. Well, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year of eating to everyone.
Everybody eats when they come to my house. Face, Buster, Share, Chop.